The perfect combination of versatile athleisure and training apparel has arrived. Thanks to the visionary minds of New Balance, Clutch Athletics, and Rich Paul, the designs reflect the heart of the athlete and the spirit of the community. With rising defensive football stars Will Anderson and Chase Young on the roster, Clutch Athletics brings the best innovative gear to all athletes, giving them style and performance on and off the field. Learn more and purchase Clutch Athletics at NewBalance.com.
Welcome back to the Cover 3 Podcast with your hosts, Chip Patterson, Tom Fornelli, Danny Cannell, and Bud Elliott. It's your call for the best college football coverage from National Signing Day to the National Championship and everything in between. CBS Sports presents the Cover 3 Podcast.
And welcome back to the Cover 3 Podcast. Here on CBS Sports, that's Tom Fornelli. I'm Chip Patterson, coming to you live at youtube.com/cover3 and all across the 24/7 Sports Facebook Network. Thank you for tuning in. Why don't you smash that subscribe, smash that like, come hop in the chat and join the conversation. It is a Thursday. That means that a good portion of the show will be opening up that big old bag of mail. Today's set of mailbag questions, as we do have just Tom Fornelli and myself today. We're going Big Ten heavy, baby. I'm just going to go ahead and let you know. We've got the Noles out the house, and that means that we get to really get in our bag. We will also, if the listeners and viewers who are following along right now want to, maybe we'll break down the new Premier League ball. I don't know. I don't know if we'll have enough time, but we begin with a headline that has been part of the ongoing response between the NCAA and the name, image, and likeness era. And it is that the NCAA has reportedly gone to take a visit down at Miami to just sniff around and start to check out how things have been going with name, image, and likeness. The billionaire John Ruiz, who has been at the center of a lot of the Miami NIL deals, has reportedly, you know, been also someone of interest. And none of this necessarily means that we are going to see Miami get charged with anything. None of this necessarily means that Miami has done anything afoul of the name, image, and likeness rules and guidelines that the NCAA has put forth. So I guess I want to start with, are you surprised that the NCAA has gone to Miami first? And number two, do you think anything's going to come out of this for the Hurricanes?
I am not surprised that they went to Miami first, because it's Miami and they're the NCAA. And, you know, they've got, you know, frequent flyer miles down there, I suppose, based on things that have happened there in recent history. But no, I'm not surprised simply because I think in this NIL world, Miami's clearly been the most public about it. I mean, they've, you know, it's like they're announcing commitments from players with sponsorships in the, you know, in the tweets, announcing players signing or committing or whatever. And as far as if I think anything's going to come of it, no. I mean, what's the NCAA going to do?
Well, the NCAA, based on my understanding, is looking to make sure that they are not using name, image, and likeness as an inducement. Like, that's the one thing the NCAA, hey, you laugh, but
what is name, image, and likeness?
Name, image, and likeness, to offer it as an inducement on the recruiting trail seems to be the piece they're going after. John Ruiz, who we mentioned earlier, you know, he has been very bold with, like, no, look, we've got good lawyers. If the NCAA wants to try to come, if anybody wants to try to pick this apart, you know, we believe that everything we're doing is not running afoul of the law. We believe that if you try to penalize Miami, if you try to penalize these players, then, you know, we're going to be able to sue you. I think that we will see the NCAA attempt to bring some charges of inducements, some charges of running afoul of the name, image, and likeness rules against some college football programs. Now, how successful will these charges be? You know, will the allegations turn into penalties? I don't know. I believe that the NCAA is not going to go after players. I think that's very, very a bad, bad, bad move, in addition to not being something that I think is very fair, but also something that's not going to be good for the PR of an organization that is, like, desperately, desperately hurting and cannot take another loss. But I think that despite all of the almost braggadocious attitude from some of these collectives and from some of these people that are empowering the NIL moves, I think the NCAA is going to try to get a couple schools and penalize the school or maybe the coach or the program, but not necessarily penalize the player. Still, I'm with you. I hope no penalties stick as a matter of personal opinion, but I'm not willing to say that nothing will come of the NCAA's efforts to try to rein in name, image, and likeness.
Nothing will come of the NCAA's efforts to try to nothing. Rein in. It's, what are they standing in the ocean screaming at the tide to stop coming in?
Yes, they are.
Okay,
they,
well, is that going to stop the tide from coming in? So like, it's the NCAA. It's been impotent for years. It hasn't been able to stop anybody from doing anything in a very long time. And every once in a while, it throws penalties at some smaller program that really doesn't have the resources to fight back. But now you're going to go after schools that can actually afford lawyers and have boosters who are willing to pay this money to get it to go. And most of them are in states where this is all perfectly legal. So the NCAA, which never had subpoena power for anything it's ever done, suddenly thinks it's going to take on like somebody outside of the athletic administration to go after them, to go try to get them to tell them what they can and cannot do in states where what they're doing is perfectly legal. And then they're going to punish schools. If the NCAA wants to punish Miami or a bunch of Power Five schools, great. That's a hell of a way to kill yourself, because they'll just leave you because you serve no purpose to them anymore. You really haven't served a purpose to them in a very long time. So this feels like, honestly, the death throes of the NCAA. It's the death rattle. They're just trying to give themselves some sort of relevance in a world in which they really don't have any anymore in college football. They don't serve any general purpose outside of, well, they've been around.
So I, as a matter of personal opinion, I agree with you. But I do think that even if it's a death rattle, I think that they will try something. And look, it might be some sanctions that we roll our eyes at, right? You know, like what happens when you held too many practices? You get an NCAA violation. You can't hold, you have your hours limited that you're able to have in the upcoming season.
Who's monitoring that, by the way?
What? The practices? Like,
when the NCAA says you're going to lose 5 hours of practice, who's monitoring that? Do they have, are they sending somebody there to count hours?
It's your compliance office. Mm-hmm. You're supposed to self-report. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And when you, you know, when you catch one of those minor recruiting violations, now you've limited the number of coaches that can go on the road. Like there are in like these long, you know, infractions reports, a lot of penalties and a lot of, sanctions and a lot of allegations that are so minor. They do make me roll my eyes, but I think that that is probably the ceiling of what we get from name, image, and likeness. But I do think that there is a floor of us seeing the headline, NCAA alleges Miami ran afoul of name, image, and likeness rules. And that headline is going to be a lot sexier than the actual like tale that will be unfolded, which will be like, wait, okay, so it's just this, they were only able to get evidence for this one deal with this one prospect, and the only penalty is that they're going to be fined $50,000. I mean, they're going to get some monetary fine and the school has to pay it. And that's it. Like that might be it, but I do think that's still at least something that could come of this.
Yes. Because you can't pay them to come to your school. You can only pay them once they're there. It's a huge difference. It's really not the same thing. Pay for play, NIL, whatever the hell you want to call it. They're totally different.
So the Miami getting visited first also made me think that it was like a backlog. Cause remember when we did a show on NIL Eve of, mm-hmm. Here on the Cover 3 podcast, and when midnight hit, Derek King was out here with college hunks hauling junk. They had an MMA gym that was ready to give deals to the entire football team. Like this was even before we've gotten into the Isaiah Wong in the college basketball scenario and John Ruiz sort of as a big-time figure and someone who we even mentioned by name several times in this episode. I was just wondering if Miami was like, okay, let's go back to July 1, 2021, and let's just start with everything we saw on Twitter. Like, is Bo Nix going to get hit up for sweet tea by the NCAA because they're so backlogged right now? They finally got an enforcement staff that's going to try to play catch up. Like, oh, sorry, we've been backordered like refrigerators and big cars right now. So we're just getting around to that.
It's not football, it's basketball, but it's the FBI was involved in an investigation. And even with the FBI doing the stuff, the NCAA was still powerless to do a lot of things because they didn't have they don't have the power. So to pretend that they have power to do anything about this is just, well, actually, I don't know that, I think if anybody's worried about the NCAA having any power to do this, it's a very pointless worry. You've got other things you can deal with instead.
A little bit of conference realignment. We saw the news that Cincinnati, Houston, and UCF will be able to join the Big 12 in 2023. That was a deal that needed to be negotiated because it was before the end of their contract. BYU will also be joining the Big 12 for the 2023 season. The American Athletic Conference has wasted no time to make sure that they've got all of their paperwork in order, not just to be able to replace those three schools, but also be able to beef up the conference. As Mike Oresko said this week, that the six schools that are set to join the American Athletic Conference, all currently in Conference USA, they will be joining July 1, 2023, which means that they will be in the AAC for the 2023 season. Those six schools are Charlotte, FAU, North Texas, Rice, UAB, and UTSA, hot as fish grease. Tom Fornelli, which of the new additions do you expect to have a big impact, a boost from the move, and what will that conference look like moving forward?
It's going to be weird because, I mean, obviously with Cincinnati, Houston, and UCF leaving, those have been three of the conference's premier programs as far as results on the field since it was formed. And that's leaving a tremendous kind of vacuum of who's going to step up and fill it. I would assume the programs best suited to do so are still there. Like I think of like your SMUs, your Memphis's. Those are programs I think that are well positioned to kind of take advantage of that. But of the six new schools, I mean, I think if you look at UTSA, it's been very good the last few years. Can they maintain that momentum? Because I think that in that market in Texas, that is a benefit. And it's clearly a program that a school that cares about its football program. They've invested a lot in the football program. They want to be a successful football team. So I think that moving up a level, as far as I guess conferences are concerned, and getting more money from it will allow them to maybe speed up that process a little bit. So I think the Roadrunners are one of the six that I would probably look at. And I think FAU, like this was a program that when Lane Kiffin was there, it was winning Conference USA titles. And I think that it is in a good location within Florida as far as recruiting is concerned. If you get the right people in charge there and you get everybody kind of pulling in the same direction, you know, UCF is leaving. So there's, you know, that kind of Florida spot. You still got South Florida you have to deal with. But I think that they're in a decent enough position where I don't think they're going to step in and start winning American Athletic Conference titles within the first 2 years. But I think 4 or 5 years down the road, if they make the right moves, that's a program that I think could establish itself as one of the better programs in the conference.
Moving to the American Athletic Conference is a move up from Conference USA, undoubtedly, right?
Yes. Yes. And I also think UAB too.
But yeah, that's where I was going. It's like, consider what the jump then has been from UAB from like back from the dead to competing at the top of Conference USA to now all of a sudden getting a chance to be in the American Athletic Conference. And like, as we're looking at 2022, just the season ahead, you know, UAB, UTSA, we're looking at them again to be two of the best teams in Conference USA. They make that jump. I'm not expecting a big change to happen to the Blazers program with the move. I think that they will be a fascinating team to watch even in year one.
Yeah. I mean, UAB is just a solid program. The question is, they've been very good in Conference USA, and I still expect that they'll be solid in the American Athletic. It's just once you add a couple of bigger programs to the mix, will they still be able to have that same kind of success? My inkling is that they probably will. I just don't think it'll be immediate. I think there could be a couple years there where it's, you know, they're getting bowl eligible, but they're not really, you know, running rampant in the conference.
If you're just showing up to the show a little bit late, Norman asked in the chat, why are you guys fixated on Miami? Why aren't you talking about the $8 million deal that Tennessee gave Nico? Well, it's a headline. The NCAA is reportedly visiting with Miami and some of the boosters around it. I would imagine that given how much has been written and talked about Tennessee's collective, that
they'll be there.
They'll be in Knox. I mean, come on. Aren't they already there because of the Jeremy Pruitt and the and McDonald's bags of cash? Like Tennessee is another one like Miami where they've already got all the hotels staked out. I mean, NCAA enforcement might already have rooms on already booked.
Just trying to justify those salaries.
Tom Fornelli versus the NCAA here on a Thursday. All right, let's get into the big old bag of mail. This first question reads, nice work as always, guys. Question, what was the biggest offseason move that will impact the 2022 season that did not involve a quarterback or a head coach switching teams?
This was a pretty tough one to answer because, like, most of the biggest moves that will impact the season directly involved quarterbacks and coaches because those guys have the biggest ones. But I would say, as far as players, I went with Jahmyr Gibbs to Alabama from Georgia Tech because I looked at that Alabama team last year. And, you know, a lot of Alabama fans will tell you, like, hey, if we hadn't lost Jameson Williams, if we hadn't lost Mechie, you know, we hadn't had guys injured, we'd have beat Georgia in that title game. But we were down to like our third string receivers, backup tight ends, a whole bunch of stuff. And I think that if you put Jahmyr Gibbs on that team last year, they're better equipped to withstand those injuries in a game like that because Gibbs is a player that Alabama just hasn't really had one of in the last few seasons. Like, he's a very good running back, but he's also an excellent receiver out of the backfield. So I think when you add that element back to the Alabama offense with the receivers that they have as well, this becomes, and it's already a really hard offense to stop. Now you're adding another weapon to it in another part of the field, meaning the defense has even more areas that they really need to be concerned about covering, and you can't cover the entire field. So they become much more difficult to stop. So even though he's not going to be a workhorse running back, as far as players are concerned, I think Gibbs. I have a couple other ones, but I would like to know what you think about some players.
I am the one that I targeted is going to be teammates with one of the most high-profile head coaches, or teammates with one of the most high-profile quarterbacks and playing for one of the most high-profile head coaches. But in terms of impact, not just on the field, it will impact this season, but also what he left behind and sort of what it did for us looking at the transfer portal era. But the move of Jordan Addison from Pitt to USC for a whopping nice little sum of name, image, and likeness.
Now, is that NIL or pay for play?
I think that one was the real stunner. I mean, Pat Narduzzi being very outspoken, the tampering allegations, and sort of the way that lined up with all the spring meetings, because it was right at the end of May or the beginning of May for him to get his name in, the end of May for the announcement that Addison would be going to USC. He's the reigning Biletnikoff Award winner. It was decided by the voters that he was the best wide receiver in college football, and he is up and leaving after participating in spring practice, and he's going to be joining a team with a ton of other transfers. They're like, Caleb Williams is the quarterback. Lincoln Riley is the head coach. There's tons of other transfers that are on that roster for the transfer portal all-stars of Troy. But I think that Jordan Addison, not only because of what he brings with his individual talent, but also just what he left behind with the disappointment at Pitt and what he can do to take that ceiling and raise it even more. That was the one that stood out to me.
I have a couple in the Pac-12 that are off the field. And I think Jordan Addison is a very good call. It was him. I think that that's obviously going to have an impact on USC. But I think that even though he's a great player, I feel like there's been enough other changes at USC, whereas him alone, I didn't consider the biggest. But I think if you look at the Pac-12, like the ability now to get rid of your divisions and the Pac-12 doing it immediately, I don't think it's going to put a Pac-12 team in the playoff, but I think it greatly increases the odds of putting a Pac-12 team in the playoff. Because if USC does go on to have like a great season right away under Lincoln Riley and be competing for the conference title, it's going to get that additional conference championship game. Because when you look at the North this year, I still think Oregon's a very good team. I think Washington can be a lot better than last year. I think Oregon State could be better. I think Washington State could be better. I think Stanford could be better. But I don't know if any of those teams are going to be elite or like great. Mm-hmm. So if USC won the South and it got to the Pac-12 championship and it was facing an Oregon team that was good, but maybe it's 9-3, I don't know if that would be a big boost. But let's say Utah has another great season and they, you know, they play their game, whatever. One of them's 11-1, one of them's 10-2. That increases, then instead of being in the same division and not being able to face each other in the title game, they would get to play each other in the title game, which could, depending on who wins, increase the Pac-12's odds of getting a team in the playoffs. So I think that's a big kind of move as far as college football landscape. Oh, but I think
a USC-Utah rematch in the Pac-12 championship game would be huge, and the winner would have the best chance possible to be able to go on to the college football playoff. Like that's, I like that call a lot.
Yeah. And I mean, it's not, again, it could be Oregon again. It could be the same thing as we saw. It could be Oregon going 11-1 facing an 11-1 USC. I'm just saying it increases your odds of making sure that since you get the two best teams in there, it's going to increase their chance of getting to the playoffs. So I think that's a huge move as far as college football is concerned. And another one, I know we weren't supposed to mention the coach. So maybe this is cheating because this isn't a coaching change. It's a decision to stick with a coach. I think Arizona State not firing Herm Edwards could be huge for Arizona State.
Good?
No, bad.
Okay, because, All right, I agree.
Because of that changing landscape now in the Pac-12, where USC clearly seems to be en route to a come-up, Utah has been tremendous. Oregon seems to really be establishing itself. I mentioned some other teams in the North are kind of, you know, there's reason to believe they're going to improve this year. I think UCLA, I don't know, we'll see. Like last year, they took a step forward. They could be. And then you look around, like Arizona, I think, is moving in the right direction. And I think that Arizona State could find itself kind of buried beneath a lot of teams that are moving in the right direction at the wrong time. And it could be, it could take a long time for them to be able to dig out if they're able to dig out of it. But, and then I also too, like I read a story on The Athletic, it was Doug Haller wrote it, which it was a what if scenario. And it's something that I hadn't even thought about in a while because I kind of forgot he was there. You know who Arizona State's offensive coordinator was when they fired Todd Graham and then hired Herm Edwards?
It was Billy Napier.
Exactly. And I forgot. Yeah. It was a what if scenario because even though Napier wasn't like a candidate or widely considered as a candidate for the gig, it was just basically, what if Arizona State had just promoted Billy Napier to head coach instead of hiring Herm Edwards? Where would the program be right now? And it was like, oh God, if I'm an Arizona State fan, that's probably keeping me up at night these days.
That's, I mean, well, the good news is if you're an Arizona State student, you're at Arizona State. So, you know, that's things can get a little bit, things are okay. What else in any others that stood out to you? I like your Jahmyr Gibbs call because I've also been thinking about Alabama's offense. And you know, Jahmyr Gibbs and Tyler Harrell from Louisville in particular just feels like a lot of just break, like a lot of long touchdowns. Like, I don't know if Alabama's going to lead the SEC in touchdowns of 30 plus yards, but they've got a really good chance to be able to lead the SEC in touchdowns of 30 plus yards. And it doesn't even require Bryce Young to be airing it out. Like, I don't want to call it the dirt bike offense, but there's just a lot of speed and like big time playmaking. And Jahmyr Gibbs is without a doubt a big part of that.
Yeah, because like if you look at Georgia's offense last year, and obviously, like, you know, they played in the title game, so that's why I'm going to Georgia. But like you look at it, and it wasn't explosive or as explosive overall as of Alabama's, especially out wide, outside the numbers because of the quarterback that they had. But what they did have, which kind of brought the other dimension to them, is they had James Cook, who was a guy who you can get the ball to out of the backfield, whether handing off to him or throwing to him, who was dangerous. He was capable of scoring from anywhere he was on the field because he's that fast. He's that quick. He can move. And that was kind of an element that Alabama didn't have last year. Like Brian Robinson, good running back, but you're not really worried about him breaking huge plays, taking off for 70-yard touchdowns or being a, like incredibly dangerous outside of the backfield. Like you could put a linebacker on him and you're pretty confident he'll be able to make the tackle at least and maybe give up a few yards, but you're not totally worried about it. You can't really put a linebacker on Jahmyr Gibbs. And if you do, he's probably going to get cooked.
They're going to do it a lot.
Yeah.
It's going to be very, very, very fun to watch. Coming up on the other side, we turn our attention to the Michigan quarterback room, and we ask the question, you just signed a big old contract, but how long is it going to be until James Franklin starts to feel real job pressure at Penn State? That and more next. The all-new Hyundai 2024 Santa Fe is equipped with everything you need to break free from the dull work week and embark on an adventurous weekend with your family. The all-new Hyundai Santa Fe's features ensure that you can take on any adventure. What kind of features? Well, how about the available H-Track all-wheel drive so you can take on the dirt trails and kick up some mud? Or the standard third row seating so your whole family can experience the thrill together? How about available dual wireless charging pads so no one gets stuck in the great outdoors with a dead phone? We're always trying to think about those great spring and summer getaways, but with a car like the Hyundai Santa Fe, anywhere can be your next adventure. To learn more about the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe, go to HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for complete details. Learn more about the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe at HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for complete details.
If you're in the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale marketplace where each piece is carefully vetted and verified by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. If you're in the market, use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Back here on the Cover 3 podcast. Again, if you want to submit a question to a future mailbag episode, you can do so by leaving us a 5-star review. And then in that review, put your question. We'll add it to the big old bag of mail, tackle it in a future mailbag episode. This next question comes from Seth. Amazing podcast. The only college football pod I listen to because there's no point of listening to any others. Great balance of characters on the show. First question, is the McNamara-McCarthy situation a good comp to Clemson's situations with Cole Stout and Deshaun Watson or with Kelly Bryant and Trevor Lawrence? I see Cade McNamara as a capable quarterback, but not a game changer like J.J. McCarthy. Should Michigan make the switch? Before we get to that, second question is for Tom. I told you, we're really going for the Tom's bag here. Second question is for Tom. What are your thoughts on the recent announcement of Illinois getting new uniforms in 2023? What are you hoping to see?
I'll start with the second one first because I don't care. As long as they're... The thing with Illinois uniforms is it's hard to do anything super interesting because Illinois does not have an interesting logo. It's just a block eye. So it's hard to really get anything fun out of that. And they're going to be orange and blue. So as long as they're not just other Syracuse, like Nike doesn't put out the same template that they did for Syracuse, which is what they did last time, I'll probably be okay with it. But I don't really have uniform thoughts. I hope they don't look stupid.
Michigan quarterback situation.
I'm on the record. I as a person outside the room, just from what I see of the two, I would rather have J.J. McCarthy starting. I think you have a higher ceiling with J.J. McCarthy. I think he adds another element with his legs and mobility that, I mean, it's not like Cade McNamara is not a statue, but he doesn't have the same kind of mobility that McCarthy has. And I think that kind of limits what Michigan wants to do. But I also understand, like, maybe there's more trust with McNamara not to make the backbreaking killing mistake that could hurt you. And we saw that last year. Like McNamara, like he wasn't like a game manager. He was better than that, but he wasn't like blowing people away. And Michigan was having success just running the ball a lot and then play action kind of passing, just going off of that. And it was effective because they had terrific defense and they didn't have to take a bunch of risks on offense. But I still think that even though you beat Ohio State last year with McNamara, longer term, to make it more likely to beat Ohio State again this year and the year after that, you need to have more dynamism at the quarterback position because Ohio State is going to be a better defense this year. Like, I know we haven't seen a single game with Jim Knowles there, but just based off what Jim Knowles has done in his career and the talent that is on that side of the ball, it's going to be a better defense. It's going to be more difficult to do what you did to them last year again this year. I don't think you can just beat them up. And that's what they did last year in the snow in Ann Arbor. They just beat Ohio State's defense up. They ran through them. They ran over them. They ran around them. It was a very impressive display. But I don't think you can count on that year after year. So I do think they have a higher ceiling. I would go with McCarthy. I don't know how that coaching staff feels right now. Actually, I do think I know how one person that's pretty important on that coaching staff feels right now. I'm pretty sure they're going to lean McNamara, and he will be the starter when the season begins.
Is that Jim Harbaugh?
Yeah. And I think that I think Michigan can win with him. They just got to the playoff last year with him. So it's not like I sit here and think that Michigan's going to be bad. Oh, they're going to be 8-4 because they don't have J.J. McCarthy starting. But I think you have a higher percentage chance of winning the Big Ten with McCarthy and getting back to the playoff than you do with McNamara.
So if I'm a Michigan fan and I'm one of those twisted ones that is rooting against the success of the starting quarterback because I want to see the backup quarterback in there, the start to the season is not going to fare well. Cade McNamara might look like an all-star as he, and let me just run that through you real quick. Opening game, Colorado State, first year coach at home. Second week against Hawaii, first year coach at home. third game against UConn with a first-year coach at home, and then you play Maryland, who could be exciting. You know, we talked about how, you know, that wide receiver room is great.
They present problems.
They present some problems, especially for a defense that's going to have a little bit of turnover. But then this is where it gets dicey, because fifth game of the season, October 1st, you're going to play at Iowa. So are you waiting for McNamara to struggle at Iowa to put McCarthy in there? Or are you hoping that because all these other games are blowouts, that McCarthy has gotten a lot of good second half action to be able to, you know, get fully into the rhythm, get his feet under him, when you will probably need the mobility and you will probably need the more versatile skill set to be able to beat a very, very good Phil Parker-led Iowa Hawkeyes defense?
I think that it's probably more the latter, in that both McNamara and McCarthy will get a lot of snaps in those first three or four games, probably definitely the first three games of the season, and both will probably play very well. So you will not be able to justify taking McNamara out for McCarthy. I think that McCarthy will probably see plenty of snaps in the Iowa game too, regardless of what happens, whether he's starting or not, because that is a defense that's very good and you're going to want to present different looks. And maybe you're going to need a spark to get something going on a drive. And we saw last year, like, McCarthy did get snaps. Like, it's not like it was all McNamara. They put him in, they have sets with him. They have, you know, certain things that let run. I think we'll see an expanded playbook with him this year in his second season. It's just, unless McNamara is screwing up and hurting the team's chances to win, I don't think you're going to see McCarthy. And I think that could be a problem for Michigan, because unless this is, you know, we just see it now with the quarterbacks who don't really like sticking around and waiting for a chance to play. And if you're J.J. McCarthy, maybe he's different. Maybe he just wants to be at Michigan. Maybe he's willing to sit and wait his turn. Maybe he's like, all right, I'll be the other guy this year, and then once Cade's gone, I can finally step in and take it. And if they know that's the case, then I completely understand what they're doing. But I would just be worried that in this transfer portal era, if J.J. McCarthy's sitting there and he's playing well when he gets his shot, but he knows he doesn't really have a shot to be starting anytime soon, he might be trying to, you know, see what else is out there.
Also, it's June, middle of June, and we're already starting to talk ourselves into these, like, very strong thoughts. But throw me also on the growing number of people on the boat that believe that Michigan, even after all the losses, still is going to end up being okay. Because, yeah, I mean, Penn State game at home, Michigan State game at home. I mentioned that Charmin soft start to the season. The Iowa game is admittedly very tough, but like Nebraska, they come to Ann Arbor. Your other road game in your road game in November, other than Ohio State, is Rutgers. Like, Ohio State will probably get its revenge at the end of the season in Columbus, but that is probably, in my opinion, going to be a loss that leaves Michigan sitting at, I don't know, 9-3. You know, like, not a bad season at all. Maybe 10-2.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it'll be interesting to see what happens with Michigan State and Penn State. And I've got a story going up next week that I got to write about teams that are probably poised for a bounce back next year, or maybe, you know, falling down. And Penn State is one of those teams. There's some stats underlying that, you know, suggest the last few years might have been just some bad luck and things could bounce back. And on the other side, Michigan State is a team that suggests that we might see a drop off based on what they had last year. But I think that just looking around the conference as a whole, even though I think Ohio State's clearly the best team and is going to win the conference far more often than not, I'm pretty sure Michigan's still the second best team in the conference, even with everything that they lost.
So this is more of a, I mean, there's not really a question here, but this is so much fun, I had to read it. So, Nick, hi guys. I got a huge laugh when Tom read my CJ Carr post on MGo blog on the show, which, Tom, if I remember, was Michigan fans really going through it with like a, we don't really need him anyway type approach. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Talking about Lloyd Carr's grandson committing to Notre Dame. This is what Nick says. Hi, I got a huge laugh when Tom read my CJ Carr post on MGo blog on the show. I'm a huge Cover 3 fan and always wanted to get on the show. My dream has finally been realized. Congratulations, Nick. The funny part is that 99% of the time, I am a, quote, voice of reason type fan and poster. I am a Michigan alum from the early Carr years, so I guess it triggered some temporary insanity. My daughter actually knows CJ and tells me that he is a good kid and that everyone knows that his family are great people. I won't be rooting for him at Notre Dame, but I'll be very excited when the Lions pick him first overall in the 2028 NFL draft. Love the show. Can't wait to hear where you draft Blake Corum and Donovan Edwards in the upcoming running back draft.
First of all, I love that he's not going to root for CJ Carr because he's at Notre Dame, but he also understands that by the time CJ Carr is leaving college, the Detroit Lions will still suck and will still have
the first overall pick.
Like, he clearly, if he's a Michigan guy, he loves Aiden Hutchinson, but he doesn't think Aiden's going to fix the Detroit Lions. He knows they're still going to be picking first.
All right. Keeping it in the Big Ten. Let's go. This question is from Ryan in Maryland. Hey guys, love the show since I found it this past season and have been letting my fellow college football fan friends know about you. Thanks. That is the off-season challenge for all of our listeners. I was very excited when we got James Franklin after Bill O'Brien, and he has certainly moved the program into the modern era from the Joe Pa days. However, it appears we have hit a ceiling of good but never great. He got Drew Allar to come to Penn State, but I think the pressure is on now even more so. Do you guys think if Franklin can't turn this around and develop Allar quickly, will Penn State finally move on? And I may be just a conspiracy theorist, but the new Penn State athletic director was the athletic director for Temple when Matt Rhule was hired. Rhule is a Penn Stater from State College. Just saying, .. Thanks, like button smashed from Ryan in Maryland.
So we know what Penn State message boards are going to be saying for the next few years.
That, why would you want to hire Matt Rhule?
I don't know. I feel like Matt Rhule's star. I mean, I think that we've seen it too many times. College coaches are successful. College go to the NFL, fail. And in a lot of people's eyes, it kind of ruins them as far as their stock. And then they come back to college. It's like, oh, no, wait, they're still pretty good at this. So I don't think Matt Rhule's stock is down, but I completely understand why nationally some people would be like, really? Have you seen what he's done with the Panthers? But as far as James Franklin, I think that James Franklin is already kind of on the hot seat with a decent portion of the Penn State fan base. And I think that when that happens, you can't rule anything out. But, and this is a pretty large but, the man did just sign a 10-year contract extension.
And $70 million guaranteed.
And if you look at the buyouts on that contract, if you fired him now, it's $72 million. If you fire him in 2023, it's 64. 2024, it drops to 56. 2025, it drops to 48. 2026, 40. So even if it's 5 years from now, to buy him out of that contract is going to cost you $40 million. Now, God knows what college coaches are going to be getting paid 5 years from now, considering the way things are going. But we could also see the market shift direction where that more of that money goes to players than it does to coaches. Who knows? I just think that is a large pill to swallow, but maybe when the Big Ten signs its new TV deal, it becomes more feasible for Penn State to swallow that kind of money and move on if things get that bad. But man, I feel like for Penn State to want to pay that much to make James Franklin go away, things will have to get really bad. And I don't see things going really bad. Like I kind of mentioned a few minutes ago, I think that Penn State is a team that's going to be good this year. It's going to get back to normal. I know they've had a couple down seasons, but there are numbers that suggest there's some bad luck involved there. And I think we're going to see a course correction this year. I think Sean Clifford being in his second season with the same offensive coordinator for the first time in his career will be big for him. It will be good for the offense. And if it's not, I think if Drew Allar is able to step in and, you know, lives up to the hype, that will be good for the offense. But I just think this is still going to be a team that's going to win 9 games, probably in all likelihood, compete in the East, go to a major bowl game. And no, that's not the playoff, but that might be the playoff in a few years. So will you want to be paying James Franklin $56 million to go away when he's getting at-large berths to the college football playoff? I doubt it.
Well, the high floor is what I would take.
Yes.
As a Penn State, if I'm putting myself in the shoes of a Penn State fan, I know it's very difficult for me, uninvested Chip, to be able to tell you, heavily invested fan, how to feel about things, but the consistency that you're able to get, and as you mentioned, like there have been some frustrations. I mean, you know,
they've been a mediocre football team the last 2 years, results wise.
2 years, the results have not been good. And to watch every one of those overtimes probably took a lot of
Well, they just lost to a better team that day.
It added a lot of joy for the two of us. But, you know, for a Penn State fan, I understand what that might have done to your psyche and your overall emotional state regarding the Nittany Lions. But I am so much more in on the idea of, oh, like James Franklin, he just keeps going 9-3. He keeps going 9-3. And to your point, if a college football playoff expansion is coming, Penn State going 9-3 against a schedule that includes Ohio State every year, Michigan likely every year. I don't know what their protected rivalries would be if they move away from divisions. Mm-hmm. But I got to imagine that Ohio State and Michigan remain very much at the core of Penn State scheduling principles.
Well, Richard Aitchison asks in the comments, he says, will getting rid of divisions help any program more than Penn State? I do think they would be helped by that because I don't know who their premier or their regular rotating rivals would be, but I do think that the two newest programs in the Big Ten would be viable candidates because there is a quote-unquote rivalry between Maryland and Penn State, and it could be Penn State and Rutgers. So you might see two of Penn State's protected rivalries every year being Rutgers in Maryland, which means at worst,
green light, let's go. Yeah.
And then you've got the land grant trophy with Michigan State. So I wouldn't be shocked if Penn State's protected games are Michigan State, Rutgers, and Maryland, which means you're not playing Ohio State and Michigan every single year anymore, which would be a tremendous boost to their floor. And it would increase their ceiling a little bit too, because it would just increase their odds of finishing in the top two and then facing Ohio State or Michigan in the Big Ten championship. But at this point, we've probably got the expanded playoff. And again, they're going to be a viable candidate for one of those at-large bursts every single year. And if you're getting to the playoff, I don't think you're going to be having reasons to fire James Franklin.
No, a top three possibly team in the Big Ten is always going to be a contender for a 12-team playoff.
Mm-hmm.
And Penn State absolutely can be that. Imagining those buyout numbers as you just read them out was hilarious because I was remembering even this past offseason, a Power Five program sweating a $14 million buyout. Mm-hmm. If a $14 million buyout is giving you pause on what you're going to do and making you really like have to reach out to boosters and make some tough decisions, imagine what 56.
Yeah.
You know, like that's ridiculous.
Like the only way he's getting fired in those seasons is if he's done something that it allows Penn State to wiggle out of the buyout because they've got, you know, cause or whatever, you know, that kind of stuff.
Mm. Yeah. And that's if James Franklin faces pressure, then the pressure will come from people digging around to see if there's any reason that they can fire him for cause. Like he would have to get Pruitted for him to be run out of state college here in the next couple of seasons.
And I don't know that happens at Penn State as much as it does at Tennessee, which is a place that I love because it is insane.
Right. And 100% agree. All right. This next question comes from Chi-Town. Longtime listener to the pod and will always refer Cover 3 to all of my friends. Thanks. I recently bumped into a Clemson fan and a podcast listener at a Dallas airport bar. Shout out to Jay from Atlanta after he commented on my Tuck Cummins shirt. Do you like the Tuck Cummins movement?
I don't even know what it is.
Oh, it's Michigan State fans. It's Michigan State fans. Mel Tucker, like you say.
Oh, okay. Tuck Cumming. I thought you meant, I thought there was some guy, like a designer named Tuck Cumming.
No. Like
Mel Tucker's coming. I got it. Mel Tucker
is coming. Yeah, Tuck Cumming. You holler after he gets a big win on the recruiting trail. Tuck Cumming. I mentioned and warned him that Dabo is starting to sound like Mark D'Antonio towards the end of his career. Dabo, like D'Antonio, refuses to make external hires and just reshuffled responsibilities internally, refusing to adapt to the changing landscape, refusing to adjust scheme to fit roster, and stubbornly sticking to players who have waited their turn over younger players with higher ceilings. What are some coaches that you think dug their own grave that led to their demise or forced retirement, and is Dabo in danger of becoming one of them? Thanks and go green, Tuck Cumming. I say no. I mean, I'll go ahead and jump out on this. Brian Brzee arrived at Clemson and he was a starter. Like I'm not trying to go in reverse order here, but when there have been superstars like Dexter Lawrence played right away. Like if you are the most gifted player at the position. Seniority has never been, and not never, but seniority is not something that is put above talent when it comes to Clemson and depth chart decisions. The reshuffled responsibilities, no external hires, is potentially a very, very valid criticism, but I don't think that we can say that the grade is final until we see what happens this year after having to do the massive shakeup following the loss of Tony Elliott and Brent Venables, replacing him with some of the coaches that are on the reshuffled staff were technically external hires. They just also had been at Clemson earlier as a graduate assistant or as an analyst. So they all had ties to the program. We'll see whether or not that works out. Dabo is certainly of the belief that having those connections are going to end up making him, that are going to end up making a difference in helping the transition. And then for the, you know, refusal to adjust to the new era, Dabo is without a doubt stubborn, but we also just saw him adjusting some of his own policies in terms of official visits in June. So it does seem like there's a little bit of bend from Dabo Swinney on that.
Yeah, I pretty much agree with all that. I think the only, like, kind of like you, I think the one area that concerns me, and I don't even think that's really the case at Clemson, I'm just saying in general, is the problem with the internal hires and the promotions is that it's hard to be innovative when it's the same people talking all the time. It's like sometimes you need fresh voices from other places with maybe some different ideas to come in just to kind of push things forward and help you see things differently and help you improve. I think that's just the kind of the way nature works in general, not just football programs. So I do think that any program, whether it's any coach, is just kind of not bringing in outside people and just keeps promoting from internally, I think eventually you will stagnate. Yes. So not Clemson, but any program that does that probably will face trouble at some point.
Clemson was also on the edge of offensive innovation 10 years ago, but now the offense looks 10 years old.
Mm-hmm.
With really good players, it can be very, very productive. And there are not a lot of ACC defenses that are able to get out there and have the players that can keep up because of how well Clemson has done with recruiting and player development. But you know, it'll be, that's the thing that I'm probably looking at the most, is to see, we went from Chad Morris to Jeff Scott and Tony Elliott. Jeff Scott leaves. Now it's Tony Elliott. And yes, Brandon Streeter was the quarterback's coach and he's, you know, come up through the entire run, but we've got a new pass game coordinator and a new, some shuffled responsibilities that I know it was said as a negative thing, but I will be paying close attention to the Clemson Tigers offense to see if it does look like they are trying to put in some new wrinkles or if they're still running the Clemson offense. As Dabo said, when everyone said, are you still going to run the Chad Morris offense? He's like, it's not the Chad Morris offense. It's the Clemson offense. So I wonder if the Clemson offense is going to get a software update with some of the change in responsibilities.
And will they have any receivers under 6'2"?
They have not changed their player profile at the wide receiver position. Though I was looking at the wide receiver coach talking this offseason and kind of calling the room out for not being, and this is something that's so small, but for not being great at like downfield blocking. And I kind of forget that if you're going to be all big, you better
block.
Be good. Yeah. You better be able to help us with the perimeter run game. I mean, so many of those long Travis Etienne runs, like those can really get sprung by being able to have one of those Cadillacs on the outside, getting in front of a defensive back and opening the lane. And when you've got a great running back duo with Will Shipley and Kobe Pace, I think that that's going to be interesting to see whether or not those wide receivers are going to answer the challenge, bring some toughness, some physicality, and some oomph to be able to spring some big runs on the outside. All right, let's go right here. One last one. This question comes from C-Slack. All right. Hey, y'all, love the show. What's your favorite Group of Five conference? And then the next part of it, if you had to pick 3 to 5 teams from the Group of Five to make a New Year's Six Bowl this year, who would they be?
I'll start with the second part because it's unfortunately the most boring answer to me. I think it's the same. I think Cincinnati, Houston. And then for the third, I'm kind of torn between SMU, who I think is something of a dark horse. They've got a new coaching staff coming in, but they've got a lot of returning production from last year's team. And I think that, you know, defensively, I think that could undo them, but I think offensively, they're going to be able to score plenty of points. So that makes them dangerous. And then I would go with Utah State as something of a dark horse to get that spot. But I think that more than likely, for the next few years, that's going to come from the AAC until Cincinnati, or not even the next few years, but while Cincinnati, Houston, and UCF are all still in that conference, I think they're going to be the favorite for the New Year's Six spot. As far as my favorite group of five conference, that's kind of a tricky one to answer, because I just regionally, I like the MAC. I'm familiar with the MAC. I've watched the MAC for years. I enjoy MACtion weeknights late in the season, but I kind of have more of an affinity now for the Mountain West, simply because of timing. Because until the MAC starts playing on weeknights, they're generally playing at the same time as everybody else on Saturday. And no offense to the MAC, I am not going to watch a Toledo Bowling Green game over a Big Ten game, an SEC game, what have you, if there's a bigger game on. Meanwhile, Mountain West is typically playing late at night. So after a lot of the major Power 5 primetime games are finishing up or wrapping up, you change the channel, and there's a Mountain West game. And they've had some good, fun teams over the years. Like every year, there's always at least one team in that conference that is just really fun to watch. And then, of course, there was always at the end of the night when everybody else has gone to bed and just us true degenerates were still awake before Chip had kids and I got old, there was Hawaii football and we would watch that. So I have always kind of had an affection for the Mountain West simply because I see the Mountain West live a lot more than I do the other group of five conferences.
Sun Belt. Fast answer.
Favorite.
That's just, it's one of my favorites. I think that, you know, Louisiana being really strong, well, it was adding like a lot of intrigue to that. So I do hope that, you know, with Billy Napier's exit, with them deciding to promote internally, I hope Louisiana stays a very strong program. They were extremely experienced. I will be expecting a little bit of a drop off just because you lost not only your head coach, but so many of your most important players. But App State and Coastal Carolina, again, like to your point about the MAC, the strength of the football programs at App State and Coastal Carolina have made being here in North Carolina very, very fun because the either like fair weather fans or just, you know, other fans will just jump on board. There's a lot of excitement. There's a lot of buzz. I live across the street from a sports bar and oh my gosh. Like, cause of the App State and Coastal Carolina are going to play on a Tuesday night. You go and you see the parking lots packed, right? And you're like, ooh, this is exciting. This is a little bit of buzz that we hadn't had before. Throw in James Madison, a program that I think is very, very good, who's going to be joining the picture there in the Sun Belt. You know, we've got a Georgia State program that is on the upswing right now, which is exciting again, like in Atlanta. I like the Sun Belt. It's probably my favorite right now. Though to your point, Mountain West tucks me in at night on Saturday, specifically the CBS Sports Network Mountain West game tucks me in on Saturday nights. It's normally about halftime when we finish our instant reaction show. So then we get to like nice and unwind with Amanda Guerra's sideline reporting and, you know, whatever confetti is flying across in the sky in Reno, Nevada. MACtion in November and midweek does give us a lot of fun and also incredible weather in a lot of those games. And we have lots of different ways to attack that, especially from the for our MAC locks. I think that it's probably Mountain West and Sun Belt for me. The American Athletic Conference is very top heavy. As you mentioned, the teams that are going to be competing for the New Year's Six bids this season are probably coming from the AAC. I mean, it'd be cool if Coastal did it or if App did it, but things have gone horribly wrong at Cincinnati. And
I just don't think Sun Belt has that kind of cred yet. But I do think, like I've talked about it, I think that 5 years from now, the Sun Belt, with just all the changes that are happening at the G5 level as far as realignment, I do think the Sun Belt's going to be the best G5 conference in 5 years.
They've just leaned into an identity and like they're chasing passionate like football fan bases no matter where you are. Yeah. So it's a cool thing and it is fun to track along. If you want to add a question to a future mailbag episode, you can do so by leaving us a 5-star review. And in that review, you put your question. We'll add it to the big old bag of mail, tackle it in a future mailbag episode. You can follow him on Twitter at Tom Fernelli. You can follow me at Chip_Patterson. Tom, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.